May I welcome you on behalf of the Australian Institute of International Affairs Victoria to this very well attended meeting. This is yet another tribute to you, Tim. I mentioned to somebody down the back there, I said, it's good to see so many people here. And this fellow said to me, of course, he's terribly well known, Tim. So it's good to have you here. And before we start, perhaps I should remind people that we are going to have a festive lunch on the 7th of December. It used to be called the Christmas lunch, but now it's called the festive lunch. We're terribly politically correct around the place. Michael Lestrange is going to be the speaker there. That will be terrific. He's now the director of the National Security College at the ANU and a very, very experienced man. And so I encourage you all to look out for that and to come along as well. So that's, as I say, on the Wednesday, the 7th of December, 12:15 for 12:30, and the location, although we think we know the location, has yet to be finally confirmed. But tonight, we have Indonesia's Democratic Spring Turns Chile, with Professor Tim Lindsay of the University of Melbourne. Is it all as it seems up in Indonesia? One is never quite certain, I find, having visited Indonesia a few times in the past. Haven't been there recently, but it's quite a remarkable country and a very varied place. And, of course, the experiences of the citizens of Indonesia varies from time to time and place to place according to all sorts of criteria. There are all sorts of difficulties and strains and tribulations running through the development of the Indonesian nation, and I'm sure that Tim will give us a lot of background which will bring us up to date with what's going on right at the moment. Now, he's going to analyse developments in our important neighbour, and he's been here before. So you will know him as the Director of the Asian Law Centre and Director of the Centre for Islamic and Law and Society at the University of Melbourne. He's also a barrister, so he's had a fairly close working knowledge of some of the problems that some of our citizens have run into when they've decided to try and circumvent the Indonesian laws in relation to drugs of various types. He's a specialist in Indonesian law, Indonesian politics, Islamic law in Southeast Asia, and the bilateral relationship between Australia and Indonesia. He's chair of the Australia-Indonesia Institute, as I mentioned, a practicing member of the Victorian Bar and an ARC Federation Fellow. He's written a number of publications, including Indonesia Law and Society, which is in its second edition, Indonesia After Suharto, Prospects for Reform, Law Reform in Transitional and Developing States, and Corruption in Asia, with Howard Dick. He's the founding editor of the Australian Journal of Asian Law. So as I was told earlier tonight, he is extremely well known and extremely knowledgeable about events in relation to this country, this very populous country just to our north. So would you please join with me now in welcoming again Professor Tim Lindsay.
It's always that moment, you know, when someone introduces you like that and you think it's probably better if I leave immediately and send you something later. It can only be downhill from here. Indonesia's Democratic Spring Turns Chile. Just a reminder of the presidents we've seen since President Suharto left. But first of all, the good news. Good news for Arabs, if you like. Indonesia's spring. I say this because Indonesia is frequently held out towards the countries in the Middle East undergoing political change as a sort of model for them. I'm not sure that they'll end up like Indonesia, nor am I sure that they necessarily want to, but it's a common pattern in the region. The United States in particular frequently points to Indonesia as an example for these Arab Muslim communities as to how they could democratize and Islamize simultaneously, which is what Indonesia, including President Yudhoyono himself just a few days ago, says is their achievement, a parallel Islamization and democratization. In particular, the thing that attracts the United States is the fact that Indonesia managed to remove the military from politics after 32 years of a military-backed authoritarian regime. The army was step by step over a period of years, completely excluded from its formally guaranteed place in the political process. Again, that was something that took place contrary to the predictions of most observers at the time, including myself. And in their place, instead, we saw this Indonesian spring that began in 98 and 99 that was led by civil society groups, including in particular Islamic organisations, Muslim community organisations, as part of that civil society-led spring, and an extraordinarily rapidly developing NGO sector as well that still plays an important part. But this wasn't a sweeping revolutionary change in the way that's occurred in a number of Middle East countries recently, or perhaps they will follow the Indonesian path of compromise as well. Because in reality, power did not move to new elites. Most political power in Indonesia has remained in the hands of people who were already in the political leadership under Suharto. And that's likely to be the case for some years yet to come. In other words, a compromise took place. The military was removed, civil society took a lead in reform, but the previous political elite reconfigured and maintained a grip on much of the new political system, this democratic model. In other words, they were elected rather than appointed, but they were still at the top. Nonetheless, they presided over the creation of a functioning multi-party democracy that has seen a series of peaceful and fair elections since then. And most importantly, perhaps, and perhaps least noticed by Australians, the creation of a genuinely open society and a free, or as an Indonesian journalist described it to me, feral media. There's no question that Indonesia has moved from having one of the most tightly restricted medias in Asia to what is undoubtedly its most open and free. That's a fairly significant achievement. More good news, economic success as well, after a catastrophic experience in the Asian economic crisis with 82% of all financial institutions and 80% of all listed companies insolvent. Think about that. 82% of all financial institutions and 80% of all listed companies insolvent. No one's quite ever managed that, except Indonesia. And the single greatest fall in any current country's currency since World War II. So after a spectacularly bad Asian economic crisis, the reconfiguration of the whole finance sector, the shrinking from hundreds of banks to dozens of banks, the intervention, not particularly helpful, of the IMF, led to a restructuring of the Indonesian economy. As a result, it was very strong when the global financial crisis hit. It has had little impact on Indonesia, and growth is close to 7%, despite all the huge problems Indonesia has faced of corruption, problems with regional government overlap in authority with the central government, weak foreign investment. Still, foreign investment in Indonesia lags well behind its neighbours, democratic or undemocratic, and far behind China or even India. But despite all those issues, it's at 7% growth or thereabouts. Mainly propped up by a massive domestic market, 240 million people, and this informal, unmeasurable, largely mysterious domestic market. Mysterious because Indonesia has one of the lowest tax bases in the world, and the lowest of the ASEAN countries, only about 4 to 5% compliance with tax. So it's extremely low. So much of the economy is outside the data. And that huge black, if you want to call it, grey is a better description, that huge grey domestic market is what props Indonesia up, which keeps its economy booming and allows it to get through issues like the GFC. Its target is 8%. If it can crack 8%, then it will be able to absorb new workplace entrants coming out of schools and universities, and then the economy will start developing its own independent momentum, as it did in the glory days of the new order in the late 80s and 90s, when it was regularly over 8%. It needs to be 8% to really boom. It's very close, and it's done it before. It could do it again. If it does, it will then transform into this very poor country with a very significant middle class, as well as a very rich tiny elite. You'll always have these two economies in Indonesia, but the official economy, the middle class economy, will start to grow. coupled with that, more good news is Indonesia's increasing strategic importance, which is really piggybacked on the rise of China. The rise of China guarantees Indonesia new global importance, because Indonesia is seen as the key to the Pacific tensions, China and the US, that are inevitably going to occur. Indonesia is seen as this neutral power that controls critical sea lanes. The Chinese Blue Water Navy can only get through to the Indian Ocean through Indonesia, the Straits of Malacca or the Lombok Straits. So Indonesia, as this non-aligned power at the end of Asia and as the gateway between the Pacific and Indian Ocean, is absolutely critical, and this is why the US and China are both giving it renewed attention, particularly the US, which is falling over itself to rejig its Indonesia policy, which, or rather its absence of Indonesia policy up to now. Indonesia is enjoying this new courting that's occurring, its new importance internationally, which will only grow as China grows. Indonesia is pursuing this new vision of itself as the superpower of ASEAN, which undoubtedly it is. It's asserting a leadership role while it's chair of ASEAN. It currently chairs that organisation. And it's transforming ASEAN into an organisation that is going to be far more interventionist. It's already, for the first time in ASEAN's history, intervened as a mediator in disputes with member states between Thailand and Cambodia, for example, and is using the chair position to reinstate itself, or instate itself perhaps, as leader of this ASEAN region community. Not all the ASEAN countries like it, but there's not much anyone can really do about it because it's overwhelming size and strategic importance. So this is a conscious policy, articulated, accepted within government, of Indonesia as a counterbalancing neutral power in the Southeast Asian region that will become increasingly important in the Asian century. More good news. Muslim groups were prominent in democratisation, but not dominant, in the sense that what we saw was a partnership between mainstream Islam and reformist organisations, not in any way a sort of takeover by what Indonesians call hardline or garis keras, ultra-conservative groups. Now, these mainstream Muslim organisations, reformist in nature, pushed the elites to deliver liberal democratisation. And Yudhoyono is right when he says that Islamisation and democratisation were not just parallel, they were hand in hand. There's no doubt that democratisation in Indonesia was to a large extent delivered by Muslim mass organisations and civil society organisations working with liberal secular reformists to push democratisation through. Why? Because they knew it would enhance their power. They wouldn't be marginal. They'd be able to work more effectively, assert power more effectively in a democratic society. At the same time, and this gives great comfort to the United States, who love to remind people of this, the overall vote for parties that identify as Islam has, without exception, declined in all the elections that have occurred in the post-Suharto period. You have seen good performance by the PKS, which is an Islamist party, but the overall vote for parties identifying as Islamic has declined, not increased. So it's a fight for a shrinking pie amongst these Islamically identifying parties. The overall vote for Islamic parties has fallen. As in Australia, as in most democracies, people don't vote on a religious basis. So Indonesia's 88% of Muslims don't vote for their religion. They vote for parties that will give them what they want, which is generally, as we'll see in a moment, anti-corruption. So there's a sort of partnership between what some commentators call civil Islam and politicians to deliver democracy, but that has not translated into an Islamist political movement. And of course, there, Indonesia's success in combating Islamist terrorism, which we again often forget, largest level of detentions and arrests of Islamist terrorists anywhere in the world outside a war zone. And all of those people have been tried in open trials, no Guantanamo needed here, in open courts, in open trials, defended by lawyers. This is quite a spectacular achievement in many ways. Australia's had a part in that, but Indonesia is right in claiming that it has been successful in combating Islamist terrorism, not in ending it. All it can ever hope to do is contain it. It's a permanent part of the Indonesian landscape and will always be there. Has always been there, will always be there, but the government has been very successful in dealing with it. Militants see these groups like Jamaat Islamiyah, with Abu Bakr Bashir in prison now. These will continue, but they may be threats, but not threats to the state. Now the bad news. This is my favourite bit. I like to be a harbinger of doom. It gets people's attention. First of all, the bad news is that despite all these wonderful achievements, and they are significant achievements, and they were ones that were not predicted when Suharto fell, they have occurred contrary to the best analysis of experts. Unfortunately, they've also gone largely without notice from the world outside Indonesia. Most Australians are completely unaware of the fact that Indonesia has democratised and become a genuine open civil society. In fact, most Australians, according to Lowy polls, believe Indonesia is still run by a military dictatorship. It's a real issue of sadness, I think, that when Indonesia has, for the first time in its history since independence, opened up, modernised, democratised in that way, at that exact moment Australia has looked the other way and is almost completely unaware of what's happened. But there is now a risk that reformasi, this reform process in Indonesia, is running out of steam. And there are three issues that Indonesians themselves identify as the reasons for this. First is anti-corruption. Is the anti-corruption effort failing because of elite pushback? Secondly, is religious freedom, the guarantees of religious freedom, failing? And thirdly, are the human rights protections introduced after Suharto's fall also proving to be empty? I heard this former Australian ambassador to Australia, Sabam Siagian, who the former Deputy Ambassador to Australia, Les Rowe, will recall, speak recently in Jakarta at the Australia-Indonesia Leadership Dialogue, and he identified those three points himself as the key things concerning Indonesia and Indonesians. They think anti-corruption efforts, religious freedom and human rights are disintegrating. Reasons for it, they give a three again. The government seems unable to act on these issues. The government seems frozen, paralysed. Secondly, and perhaps most seriously, the legislature, the national legislature, the DPR, seems to be failing. It is corrupt, incompetent, and unable to deliver on policy. And thirdly, better the devil you know than the one you don't is the anxiety. This may be bad, but what comes next? Because President Yudhoyono himself will not be able to stand in the next election because he's exhausted his two-term limit. And if he's not there, who will be? And what will it mean for these issues? If he can't fix it, can anybody else? So let's turn now to those themes, and I'll start with anti-corruption. And I'll start with this woman, Sri Mulyani. And I have to plead some bias here. I've known Sri Mulyani for many years, and she's an extraordinary person. She was Indonesia's tough and highly regarded finance minister who led an anti-corruption push in Indonesia and became one of the two leading proponents of anti-corruption reform in the country. The other was the Anti-Corruption Commission, which I'll speak about in a moment. Sri Mulyani, or Annie as she's known, steered Indonesia through the global financial crisis. She oversaw the bank bailouts early in the GFC that prevented a repeat of the runs on the banks that pulled Indonesia apart in 1998-99. And she shoved through reforms of Indonesia's spectacularly corrupt tax office. Now, all these things were greatly appreciated by ordinary Indonesians. She became somewhat of a hero, and of course utterly loathed by the Indonesian elite, because this would unravel the financial systems of political and business corruption that are fundamental to how those two institutions, politics and business, operate. She was in charge of the tax office, and she went through it, sacking people, dismissing people. At one point, she organised an anti-corruption commission raid on her own tax office, and the tax office building was surrounded by investigators without warning, with her permission, who then went through the building desk by desk, briefcase by briefcase, forcing tax officers to take off their shoes to see if there's money hidden in it. He went right through the whole building from top to bottom, and of course literally hundreds of people were arrested, charged and jailed after that. So you get a feel for what we're talking about here. This is the minister in our own department. In the process of this, she targeted companies associated with Abu Rizal Bakri, Indonesia's, probably fair to call him Indonesia's leading tycoon. More about Abu Rizal in a moment, but Bakri companies were accused of bribing the tax office to reduce their assessments, and in the course of investigations, massive corruption by his companies was uncovered. A figure called Gayus Tambunan became a millionaire, multi-millionaire with these bribes. He was in and out of jail with light sentences. The scandal really broke when, during a jail sentence, his former tax official in jail for fraud was filmed watching the tennis in Bali. And it was later discovered he'd been released from jail 36 times to see sporting events. Of course, Australians can't manage that. But she also, as finance minister, obstructed government efforts to give financial subsidies to Bakri's coal enterprises. So this got very personal. It became a war between Ani, Sri Mulyani, and Ical, as Abu Rizal Bakri is called, an all-out political, legal war. There's Bakri down the bottom with SBY. And Bakri is the elephant in the room in Indonesia because he is a Suharto-era crony. He was the pet pribumi, or ethnic Indonesian crony of Suharto's. He has a huge business empire reaching into a whole range of sectors. And, of course, he recently purchased, added to his empire, Indonesia's most popular and political party, Golkar. And I say he purchased it because he was elected chair after promising to give everybody in Golkar, all the members of the Central Committee, very significant amounts of money to, as reimbursement for their costs for attending the Congress meeting and for future campaigning. As a result, he was elected by a large majority. So he controls the most important party in Indonesia after the President's Democrat Party. And the governing coalition is effectively SBY and his Democrat Party and Ical and Abu Rizal Bakri and his Golkar Party. So the President cannot rule without Bakri. And every piece of legislation that goes through, because SBY is a minority president in the sense that his party only controls around about less than a quarter of the legislature, everything that goes through has to be haggled through, if not with Bakri, then with other politicians. So in addition to that, Bakri is probably the single most unpopular person in the whole of Indonesia, because it was his company that's seen as responsible for the huge Lapindo mud flow in Sidoarjo in East Java, which chews up soccer pitches of land with this uncontrollable volcanic mud flow that was released in the course of mining. He's consistently refused to pay the full compensation he'd promised. So he's a sort of figure of popular contempt. The campaign between he and Sri Mulyani over these corruption reforms reached a height with in both the legislature, where Golkar politicians plastered both Sri Mulyani and Budiono, the vice president, with allegations of corruption in relation to the global financial crisis bank bailouts I described to you a moment ago. Sri Mulyani managed the bailouts that stopped the GFC hitting Indonesia. Bakri's response to things getting a bit too hot was to say that she'd been corrupt, and so was the vice president, because they're both anti-corruption campaigners, both possible future presidential candidates. Repeated audits and investigations showed no truth to these allegations, but it was too much. Sri Mulyani finally resigned in May last year. to take up a position where she now holds as a director of the World Bank. Forbes magazine rates her the 65th most powerful woman in the world. I asked her about that and she said, why 65th? A lot of Indonesians say that the moment Sri Mulyani, her integrity is undoubted, despite all the allegations and all the investigations, not a shred of evidence has been produced against her. Many Indonesians therefore say that the moment Bakri, whose credibility has no weight at all, managed to oust her, was the moment Reformasi ended in Indonesia. Now, the Reformasi movement that began with Suharto's fall ended about 10 years later or so, in May 2010, marking the return to the crony politics led by the arch crony Abu Rizal Bakri himself, former Suharto crony. Will she make a comeback? There are calls for her to run for president in 2014. We'll see if she does. They've even formed a party for her as a vehicle, the Three Party, just in case anyone didn't know who it was for. Three, they named it after her. I think she's very happy being a director of the World Bank. Why would she put her head into the mincing machine? Second key figure in the anti-corruption campaigns in Indonesia is this, the KPK. Indonesia's Crusading Anti-Corruption Commission. This is Indonesia's Untouchables, an organisation set up post-Suharto to deal with corruption. Now, no corrupt anti-corruption organisation in Indonesian history has had the remotest success. All of them have been, at best, pathetic failures, and in most cases, sources of corruption themselves. But this is the exception. This is an organisation that is led by genuinely incorruptible people, with perhaps one exception, and it has been hugely successful. Until recently, it had a 100% conviction rate. If you were charged by the KPK, you were going to jail. As a lawyer, that concerns me a little bit. There's something wrong there. But anyway, it was a wonderful thing for Indonesia, and most of the people who went to jail thoroughly deserved it. So this was a spectacularly successful, highly professional, committed and impressive organisation. But at the same time that the campaign against Sri Mulyani was going on, a huge elite pushback campaign was being engineered against the Anti-Corruption Commission. And it started with the knocking off of this man, Antasari, the head of the organisation, for murdering this woman's supposed husband. She was his lover, and her husband was killed, and Antasari was jailed for organising the killing. Now, this is a very strange, very murky affair, and I think there are grave doubts about the conviction and whether I'm pretty confident he was framed for it. He probably deserved to go to jail anyway. But he was framed, I'm pretty confident, in that particular case. That was step one. The next step was the framing of two people, again, people of high integrity, high reputation in Indonesia, the two deputy commissioners of the KPK, Bibit and Chandra. And there was a police and prosecution conspiracy in which they set out to frame them for taking bribes, but unfortunately it was all recorded. And the wiretaps of the police and the prosecutors setting up the frame were uncovered and played in Indonesia's constitutional court and broadcast live like a soap opera, hence this image here, on Indonesian television. And Indonesians were riveted at their television screens as these tapes were played, hours and hours of tapes of evil prosecutors and police setting up this whole scam to frame the deputy commissioners of the Anti-Corruption Commission for corruption. In the course of it, the former chief of detectives in Jakarta, whose house is about five doors away from the house I live in when I'm in Jakarta, and who the whole neighbourhood didn't like because he never cleaned his rubbish bins up properly, said that if the KPK tries to take us on, the Anti-Corruption Commission tries to take us on, it'll be like a gecko against a crocodile. And we'll chew them up. And he said this on the tapes, and of course this took off. So you had this gecko and crocodile campaign. This says, I'm a gecko and I'm brave enough to take on the crocodile. And this sticker of the crocodile and the gecko went viral in Indonesia. You see it everywhere. And people will still... It's become a standard phrase, gecko against the crocodile. So this Gecko Gate episode, a national soapy, led to the commissioners of the KPK being exonerated and the police and prosecutors being jailed, ultimately. Question was, did it go to the palace? And there's some suggestion that it was done at least with the palace's acquiescence. Because this organisation has jailed dozens and dozens of legislators, former ministers, provincial legislators, in one case an entire provincial legislature, every member of it was jailed. It's jailed more than half of all governors in Indonesia, provincial governors so far. There's nobody immune from it. It's jailed the father of the president's son's wife. I'm not sure what that relationship is. Anyway, the father of the president's son's wife will do for these purposes. So there's nobody who is immune from the reach of the KPK at the highest levels. So the public love it, and the elite loathe and fear it, despise it. It's the greatest threat to that elite that survived right through from the Suharto period. But the real threat to the KPK is a lot more subtle. It's actually not the frame-ups, the false allegations, jailing people for these concocted on these concocted charges, although they continue. There's a number of other frame-ups that are in the public spotlight directed at the same people, Bibit and Chandra, again. The real threat to the KPK, and much more serious, and it actually will, in fact it has already begun now to destroy the KPK, it will destroy the KPK, is a series of laws that the legislators, quaking in fear that they would be the next on the list. And nobody's immune. Every single party in the legislature has been got by the KPK, including members of the president's party, very senior ones. Ministers are facing charges at present and will almost certainly be jailed, including Andy Malarangen, the golden boy, who people thought might be a new future presidential candidate, is almost certainly going to be jailed. So the parliamentarians passed laws that change very subtly, allow chief judges in regions to alter the configuration of panels in the anti-corruption court. And what it does is it allows them to put a majority of what they call career judges, judges who have been within the Indonesian judicial system, so they outnumber the specialist anti-corruption judges on those panels. And these are people who are not established judges, but experts on anti-corruption brought in. So in the past, the law allowed and guaranteed a majority of independent corruption specialist judges on the panels. Now the parliament has changed this so they'll be dominated by the institutionalised career judges. This has happened. It's going on now. And in Surabaya and East Java, the 100% success rate has come to an end. There's now been dozens of acquittals. So what's happening now is the KPK is suddenly losing cases and corruptors are getting away with it. This sign, the KPK must die, quoting from a corruptor. And underneath it says, if this happens, are you just going to sit there silently while it happens? Come on, let's do something. Stop corruption. This is the KPK pleading for public support. But I think it's too late. This is a law that's been passed and it's already starting to unravel the Anti-Corruption Commission. So in the end, it wasn't really about geckos and crocodiles, it was about legislation. Religious freedom. I'm going to go over time. I hope you'll bear with me for not a few minutes, a bit more than that. We'll get through it. Religious freedom. Indonesia is now awash with guarantees of religious freedom, including in the Pancasila, the national ideology, but new provisions of the Constitution, Articles 28 and 29, new laws, all guarantee religious freedom. This goes back, of course, to the political deal cut by Sukarno at the time of independence, that Islam would not be given a privileged position in the state, and that religion would be constitutionally recognised and required, but not a particular religion. However, the way it's turning out is that religious freedom is only for the mainstream. for the six recognized religions. There are six official religions in Indonesia. Islam, Christianity, there's two forms, Protestantism and Catholicism, they're seen as separate religions. Hinduism, Buddhism, and just Confucianism. The Constitutional Court has said that those religious freedom applies to those religions, but it doesn't apply to other religions, and it doesn't apply, the guarantees do not apply to unorthodox versions of the mainstream religions. And it has confirmed that blasphemy laws contained in the Criminal Code, in Articles 156 to 7, which make dishonouring a religion a criminal offence, can be applied to non-orthodox forms of religion. This is very significant in Indonesia because Indonesia is one of the world's great centres of unorthodox religions. In one province alone, in East Java, a recent survey found more than 35,000 different unorthodox sects. That's just one province. So Indonesia has always been known for this heterodoxy, one of the things that distinguishes it from the Middle East. Another one of the reasons, one of the big differences in the analysis about Springs is this religious heterodoxy that's marked Indonesia. So what's happening is the blasphemy law is being applied to these non-mainstream religions by the conservative Orthodox Muslim leadership. And there is an emerging pattern of persecutions whereby Indonesia's Islamic leading public Islamic organisation, the Council of Islam of Indonesian Ulama or religious scholars, issues fatwa condemning deviant groups, as it calls them. They then are attacked by vigilante groups, typically led by the Islamic Defenders Front or this other one, the Islamic Research and Study Institute. These are just bandit vigilante groups. So a fatwa is issued by the state-endorsed Religious Scholars Council. The vigilante groups attack, and what happens is the police stand by, allow the attacks to continue, and then arrest the sect leaders who are charged with blasphemy and go to jail. This has started to become the pattern of events after April 2005, when a National Congress of Conservative Islamist groups met, convened by the Islamic Ulama Council, the Indonesian Ulama Council, and a series of fatwa were issued condemning deviant groups, and after that this pattern of attacks started against deviant groups, which led to them being charged with blasphemy. So just a few examples of various sects and groups since 2005. In each of these cases, the sect was attacked by vigilante groups, the leaders arrested and then jailed for various non-orthodox activities. Some of them are pretty wacky. One of them in particular said to pray all you need to do is whistle. Whistle while you work. Variation. This man, Usman Roy, was jailed for 2 years for insisting that you can pray in Indonesian as well as Arabic. Some of these sects really are pretty strange. This is Lia Aminuddin of whose website proclaims that it's the website of the angel Gabriel, managed by Leah Eden. But she's a long-standing sect based in Jakarta. She received 2 years. But the most important case is the Ahmadiyya group. This is another heterodox Islamic sect from Pakistan that one group of it believes that there was a further prophet after the Prophet Muhammad. There may be as many as 800,000 Ahmadis in Indonesia. No one really knows. Somewhere between 200,000 and 800,000. It's by far the biggest so-called deviant sect in Indonesia, an orthodox group. These are the Islamic Defenders Front at the time of attacking a rally supporting tolerance for the Ahmadis. This occurred in June 2008 at the National Monument, where this vigilante attack by the Islamic Defenders Front with swords and canes on families of different religions, all marching in favour of religious tolerance, led not to a government crackdown on vigilante groups, but actually to a ministerial decision, a joint ministerial decision, prohibiting the Ahmadis from worshipping in public, or from even putting signs outside their mosques or buildings identifying themselves as Ahmadis. Same pattern. vigilante attacks, and the state cracks down on the deviant group. This became worse since the issue of that decree, violent persecution, has significantly increased against the Ahmadis. Attacks on their compounds, mosques, buildings burnt down. In February this year, there was a horrific attack by a mob on an Ahmadi community in West Java that led to three Ahmadis being beaten to death. There's footage on the internet which is ghastly, but reveals the savagery and the way in which it was organised. After these mob killings, the killers received 3 to 6 month sentences for assault and battery. The Ahmadi head of security who tried to defend the group against the attack received 6 months for refusing to obey a police instruction. He actually got 6 months. He got half a month more than the attacker who almost severed his right hand with a machete, who received 5.5 months. So you can see how this is playing out in Indonesia. Guarantees of religious freedom granted as part of the post-Suharto reforms, but in fact the opposite seeming to be taking place on the ground. And this has got much more serious, and many Indonesians feel that this question of religious tension over orthodoxy is becoming the single most explosive issue in Indonesia after corruption. I'll just jump through human rights issues because it's really the same issue as the religious freedom question. I'll just say that what Indonesia has done has a spectacular record of signing up to human rights conventions and passing human rights law in the post-Suharto period. I heard Indonesia's foreign minister pointing out they'd signed more human rights conventions than the United States, and I felt constrained to point out that most countries have done that. It's not that big an achievement. And that in fact some countries with appalling human rights records have signed up to the largest number of conventions. Anyway, be that as it may, it does have a good record on seriously committing to this human rights reform in the post-Suharto period, with conventions signed up to, laws passed, institutions created. The problem is that those institutions and these laws are up against entrenched elites who are looking for political credentials towards Islamist groups who they think will support them. And there is a strong push for human rights in Indonesia. There's a very strong public discourse about human rights that you only need to open a newspaper to find. It's an obsession of civil society, but it's also something that doesn't get a lot of traction when politics intervenes. The big problems that you've got are twofold. First of all, Indonesia, despite its image in Australian consciousness, is a weak state. It's a very weak state. The capacity of the government in Jakarta to do anything in Indonesia anywhere is very limited. It's a little bit like China in that respect. China out in the provinces and the distant areas, the remit of Beijing is limited, but much more so in Indonesia. It's always been, in fact, a weak state. Law enforcement agencies are also still very far behind on the reform process. They are amongst the slowest to reform, incompetent and corrupt in many cases. So there's a lack of state control at the grassroots. The further you are away from Jakarta, the weaker law enforcement becomes. The government is extremely timid on religion because it's a minority government in a coalition system in a divided legislature. The government is oversensitive about separatist issues and reacts badly on them. So you put together this weak and overreactive government, plus a real majoritarianist tradition at the moment in Indonesia. They think democracy means rule of the majority. The notion that majority rights are tempered by minority guarantees hasn't really sunk in to the political elite yet, or into law enforcement agencies. Minority governments feel obliged by the democratic process to pander to so-called majority values in an atmosphere where elections are knife edge and where political control depends on 1 or 2 percentage points in hung parliaments. We know a bit about that in Australia now, don't we? So they've been like that for the last decade or so. And it pushes these issues to the side. And that creates flashpoints. The biggest two are religious vigilante issues between Christian and Muslim sects against orthodox mainstream groups and the vigilante groups that back them up. And the second one is, of course, Papua. And We have Australia's probably leading expert on this area, Richard Chauvel, up the back there, so I won't say very much. But the problem about Papua is that Jakarta doesn't really take the issues in Papua seriously. They constantly roll out the trope that it's containable but not resolvable. In other words, we don't really care, and if they get stroppy, we'll kill them. We can't resolve it politically, but we can take security measures. And so this sort of lazy approach to Papua means that they're tend to hand it over to security forces, despite all the bad precedents of running restive provinces through the security forces, Aceh and East Timor. We just saw a few days ago 200 arrests after the military descended on the Third Papua Congress, firing shots. I'm not sure, were people killed, Richard? There's debate about that.
Five or six
killed. Yeah, breaking up this Third Papua Congress. So again, this... it's too hard, it's too difficult, rely on the security approach, we can't resolve it, we'll just contain it, and the situation is frankly deteriorating rapidly in Papua. I mention this as a flashpoint because it's not just a flashpoint on human rights in Indonesia, and the question of whether Indonesia, having lived through the loss of Timor and actually done very well in resolving Aceh after the tsunami, whether it's going to mess up Papua. It's important because it's one of the things that's a flashpoint in Australia on the bilateral relationship. Apart from idiot Australians deciding to do drugs in Bali, the other big flashpoint is Papua. It's the one thing that will explode the bilateral relationship. And it's quite likely to do that at some point in the near future. So here we are, government paralysis, 12 years on from the Reformasi period, and I am coming to the end, oh patient ones. SBY, a decent politician, probably Indonesia's most able and competent, and I think genuinely democratic leader, a man who I believe is personally committed to reform and democratisation, but a minority leader of a coalition government, of a very weak government and a weakened presidency. The democratic reforms took much of the power away from the presidency and left the palace an institution with much less power than Indonesians think it has. It can't do what they want him to do. So he's seen as a failure, I think. He's slow and cautious by instinct, and that translates into paralysed in Indonesian perception. It's not entirely his fault. In fact, it's probably not really his fault. But there is a very slow legislative process. The most corrupt institution in Indonesia at present is almost certainly the legislature. The legislature is failing Indonesia. The president is being held to account for it. He'll probably be seen as a very good first-term president and a failure in his second term because the parliament has disintegrated and deteriorated so badly. Indonesian government is now the site of rolling corruption scandals which have reached into his own party. We had the unedifying sight of the treasurer of his own party, the Democrat Party, once the great reform party that transformed the Indonesian political landscape. Now we had the treasurer vanishing overseas, caught by the Anti-Corruption Commission and arrested by Interpol in Latin America and brought back, making all sorts of claims against his colleagues. It's one of the worst of the corruption scandals that's hit Indonesia, and it went straight to the president and his own party. Nobody is yet accusing him personally, although it seems pretty clear that he has given a lot of winks and nods to a lot of people at senior levels, but his party is now perceived as deeply corrupt, as they all are. He's just reshuffled cabinet to no avail, deck chairs on the Titanic. The view is that it's a wasted second and final term among many, and great public frustration. I think that's all harsh. I think, in fact, President SBY is doing a pretty good job in some very difficult circumstances, but it means that there is great disillusionment in Indonesia. The polls consistently show what the public wants is clean, competent governance, and each time an election comes around, whether local or central, they consistently vote for the party that appears cleanest. Whether it is or not, they vote for the one that seems clean, and they vote for the leader that seems clean. It's the only issue in politics is clean, anti-corruption. Now, who are the leaders going to be in the next elections in 2014? Because Indonesian election campaigning starts almost as early as the United States. It's the only issue in Jakarta now is who's going to be the next president in 2014. Far off, though, it is. Yudhoyono can't run. The constitution won't give him more than two terms. And the choices are pretty grim. There's Bakri, Megawati, and Prabowo. Prabowo, former son-in-law of Suharto, special forces commander who openly admitted to abducting and torturing student dissidents in 98 and 99. His website still contains his interview with Time magazine where he acknowledged capturing and torturing them. One of the torture victims from that period is now one of the members of his own party. So that's Prabowo. Right. Both he and Megawati, who have partnered in the past, run hardline, extreme nationalist positions, protectionist people's economy. None of it looks good. The likelihood is a low voter turnout because of popular disgust with these leftover from the New Order leaders, and that will of course help the party machines and the extremist, in other words, the people, the hardline, the hardcore supporters of people like Prabowo or Bakri will come out in droves. And because most other voters will be staying home, their share of the pie will be much higher. What we're likely to see is, again, a minority leader, but a minority leader elected by hardcore supporters of these particular parties. So with lacking a mandate, this will probably destabilise politics, it will probably strengthen extreme nationalist views, and of course it will weaken democracy. That's if things continue the way they are now. So what's the question, the questions that people are asking? Where are the new leaders? There are none coming up through the parties. The few that have put their heads up have either been knocked out, such as Sri Mulyani, or have been removed by corruption scandals. So will history repeat? There is a widespread popular disgust with politicians, and the optimism that you saw in the first term of Yudhoyono's government is gone. People are speaking openly about comparisons with the 1950s and the failed democratic experiment, as it's said to be. And is Indonesia demonstrating again that popular politics and parliamentary rule won't work? I mean, I don't think that is the case at all, but that is what people say. Business is starting to contribute to this and become critical of democratisation, which is a worrying turn of events because they are very influential. And we are now starting to hear gossip and rumours about the army intervening. There have been a couple of statements recently by senior generals saying that if things continue to deteriorate, the army will have to think about what it can do to protect the future of Indonesia and things like that. Now, I mean, what we're talking about here is a sort of Thailand situation. We're not talking about a government taking an army takeover, but there are people who are talking seriously about the possibility of the army intervening in the event that a candidate they don't like looks likely to become president, intervening and stepping away. The army's been out of politics for a decade and it doesn't particularly want to come in, but if things continue to deteriorate, maybe that'll change. One of the leading experts, a former Minister of Defence in Indonesia, a leading expert on military reform, for the first time recently said publicly that he was concerned that the army's position has begun to shift, that it is considering a return to at least intervention. That I haven't heard previously, and that marks a shift. So let's hope that I'm being completely pessimistic. But what I'm relaying to you are the perceptions of Indonesians about the current situation. I think they're overly negative, but I think what is important is that perceptions count when it comes to political choice. So, Reformasi may be running out of steam. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tim. Who would like to ask the first question? There's hands up all over the place, right down the back.
You touched on the issue that Indonesia gets very little press in Australia apart from, wedding fights and bus busts in Bali. And it's my understanding that there are effectively almost no, if not actually no, students studying in Indonesia after years, well, at this point of Western Victoria. So I guess I have two questions. One is, what do you think we can do to address that? And is Indonesia's view of Australia similarly focused on Gunpowder and Bali in the first.
Thank you. Again, I have to be a bearer of bad tidings. One of the interesting things about the Australia and Indonesia relationship is that those who are involved in it, in the two countries, are extremely positive and supportive and enthusiastic about it. And that's true of government. And it's a bipartisan position. Whatever Tony Abbott may have said recently about not wanting to fund Indonesian schools, it was strongly disputed by his own Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs. It is a bipartisan position in both parties that Indonesia is a critical relationship and is at the centre of the sort of web of foreign relations and a very important player, which is why the embassy in Jakarta is the largest post Australia has overseas, not in the US or Europe. And that's true in Indonesia as well, that within both Parliament, within their Foreign Affairs Department, within the military, within the police, within business, people who are involved in the relationship are very positive, very strong about it. Then outside that, you've got this, for those who are not involved in it, which is the vast majority in both countries, increasing ignorance and hostility. And I say hostility because all the polls are consistent about attitudes towards Indonesia and Australia. Lowy, Morgan polls, a whole range of polls have been taken show a continued steady deterioration in Australian attitudes to the extent that it's only rated, the only countries rated as more negatively by Australians and is more threatening Afghanistan, Iraq and Saudi Arabia. So it's a ridiculous situation where this democratic country that has got a much deeper and closer government and institutional relationship with Australia than ever before is actually rating worse than it's ever done in popular perceptions. And in Indonesia, I think the hostility levels aren't so intense, but they haven't improved. The polling on this is hard to locate because they don't care. One of the ironies about the relationship is that both countries look north. You know, we look north to see to Indonesia, they look north to China and the issues in Asia. So we matter a lot less to Jakarta than Jakarta matters to us, which Australians are not aware of. They don't understand that we're not really a significant issue in Indonesia most of the time. So there's not a lot of polling about attitudes to Australia, but what is available is not good. There's a genuine belief held by most Indonesians that Australia wishes to turn eastern Indonesia into its own colonial area. Most Indonesians, even those favourably disposed to Australia, think that's our bottom line default position in the end because of our colonial past in PNG and so forth. Now, this is getting worse for a whole number of reasons. One is the unremitting negativity of the Australian media in reporting on Indonesia. You know, you can have Australians in jail in China, and that's just a bit of an issue. But if there's an Australian in jail in Indonesia, well, now that is front page news, and we need to have a scrum outside the Denpasar police station for days on end. And there really is quite an imbalance on. There's an obsession about those issues. So it's terrorism, Australians in the Indonesian legal system, natural disasters, militant Islam. That's the image coming across all the time of Indonesia. So what's happened then about Asia literacy in Australia? Generally speaking, Asia literacy is in huge trouble in Australia. If you look at the Department of Education's, the federal department's own report last year, Four Languages, Four Stories, which they released, Korean is almost completely gone from our schools. Indonesian will be completely gone in about 8 years on their estimate. 100,000 Australian school children from kindergarten to year 12 drop Indonesian every year across. In 1972, there were 1,500 odd Australians doing Indonesian at year 12. There's less than that now. The population was then about 13 million or so, and it was white Australia policy, and yet there were more kids doing Indonesian then in our year 12 than there are now. There's only about, I think, about 13 universities left in Australia, 13 or 14 universities doing Indonesian. Of those, a significant number only have one tenured staff member doing it. So it's in a crisis. Some of the statistics suggest there may be some enrolment increases in universities, but it's on a path to wipe out in the next decade unless something dramatic changes.
This side of the room. Christian.
I was asking in regards to the Indonesian intelligence bill, can you update what the situation is on that? I was hearing something that
BIA
has the power potentially to make arrests.
No, it won't have the power to make arrests, but it does have the power to carry out wiretaps.
Okay.
Yeah, everyone was terrified by the prospect of the National Intelligence Agency being able to arrest people, because that would have been a return to the new order. See, this is the issue that Indonesians are grappling with. Is there what they call a creeping new order emerging, whereby little bits of freedoms and constitutional reforms and new liberties are being rolled back bit by bit? So I've told you a pretty negative story tonight, but you've also got the pro-reform groups, largely in civil society, but also within some political parties, who are fighting this. And so bills like that would have given the intelligence services a legal power of arrest are being fought tooth and nail. Big campaigns about that.
This side. Yes, down there.
Just with respect to the law that weakened the Anti-Corruption Commission, is it fair to say that that was effectively forced on the Parliament by decision of the Constitutional Court?
No, because what happened was the Constitutional Court required the Parliament to pass a new law. This is a very technical issue, but I'll try and simplify it. The new law that allowed local judges to change the configuration of the Corruption Court panels, that was part of a law that the Parliament had to pass by a certain time in order to re-establish the Anti-Corruption Court. And that was a result of a decision by the Constitutional Court that the Anti-Corruption Court didn't have a proper constitutional basis. So it said to the Parliament, you have to pass a new law to give it a new basis. It can continue until you pass it. You must pass it by this point. Now, the legislature dragged that out because it wanted to try and cripple the Anti-Corruption Commission, which prosecutes in that court. And they were not required to change the configuration of the panels, but they used the requirement that they had to pass a new law reformulating the court to introduce measures that would stop the commission succeeding in it.
Yep.
Also a question on corruption, just a very quick comment. From what you've said, fighting corruption in Indonesia is fraught and success has not been 100% and is declining, but it's still very much better than Malaysia, where the people in government mouth platitudes about fighting it and then do absolutely nothing. But my question is there an awareness amongst thinking people in public life in Indonesia that corruption is part of the system, it's part of an equation, and with low civil service, etc., salaries and police salaries, pocketing a bribe is part of the system? Is there an awareness that to fight it effectively in the longer term, you've got to change the system?
Absolutely, there is. And in many of the particularly corrupt institutions, salaries have been increased to try and get them to a living wage level. There's been huge increases in judicial salaries, for example, over the last 10 years. There have been increases in legislative salaries and so forth as well. So, it is very widely understood in Indonesia that Indonesia has an institutionalised pattern of corruption, and part of that relates to the fact that public servants have often not received living wages, and that the only way that you can survive is to have multiple jobs or to take informal payments of different sorts. But this is not really about that. That's not the issue about corruption. Most Indonesians accept that that's a necessary evil. What this is really about is massive corruption at the elite level, where you could bribe a Supreme Court judge or a Supreme Court panel for tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, that sort of level of corruption among the elite, or where millions of dollars come out of the Reserve Bank of Indonesia because they have to bribe parliamentarians just to get a necessary law passed that would allow the Reserve Bank to carry on operations in a more appropriate fashion. In other words, the mechanisms of government, legitimate, reasonable reforms and laws cannot get through unless
money's been taken out of the system to pay bribes to people like parliamentarians or members of government and so forth. So they're quite, most Indonesians would distinguish between petty bribes, many of them don't like it of course, but you know, it's understood, but what they dislike are the massive multi-million dollar elite level bribes that distort the system. Part of the problem about all of this is the electoral system. The cost of becoming a member of parliament is such that most of them are heavily in debt by the time they reach the legislature, and they need to recoup their investment. This is complex, but it's to do with laws relating to political campaigning, to political party activity and so forth. And the fact that a politician who loses an election will quite often be bankrupted. There have been cases of politicians committing suicide after they failed at their local election because their debts are so massive that the only way they could ever repay them would have been to win the election and then to engage in graft and corruption. So as in the public service, a lot of people come in indebted by the mechanisms set up for entry into them. Now nobody wants to regulate and fix that up because too many people benefit from that process, and this means that the whole system of government, particularly when it's related to the legislature, is not working. That's what people object to. In relation to Malaysia, we had at the Asian Law Centre, my university, it's an advertisement here, message from your sponsor, we had Dato' Ambiga Srinivasan, who is the leader of the Bersih 2.0 movement, which is, Bersih means clean. This is the reform coalition in Malaysia, who had that huge march wearing yellow. They all got tear gassed by the Malaysian government. We had her speaking, and she said yesterday, before she spoke publicly, she said, you know, Malaysia, people think we're this advanced, prosperous country, but the fact is we haven't even got to 1998, referring to Indonesia. She was pointing out that they haven't even got to regime change, let alone democratisation and transparency, the way Indonesia did 12 years ago. So Indonesia, in the sense of democratisation and open society, is far advanced on the Malaysian situation. But and that's why we know about the corruption scandals. These corruption scandals have always gone on. Now they're being reported because you can. So the question now is, will the advance they've made, is it sustainable? Can it maintain itself at that level? Or is it going to start slipping back maybe towards the Malaysia position?
Yes.
I was wondering about the role of big foreign mining and big foreign business, perhaps that Newmont, Freeport. They're both being challenged within the system. Like Newmont, I think, was charged under the new environmental law, but at the same time, they're probably in conflict with the elite and they're certainly responsible for a lot of the human rights abuses.
I'm not sure what the question is, though, Alice.
What's the role of yeah. big mining firms?
Well, there's a sort of tension in Indonesia, which is that the government desperately wants foreign investment. And obviously the mining sector, the resources sector, is a key area of interest for the government. Miners would like to be in Indonesia. The resources are rich. And once you're in and established, wages are low and so forth, conditions are pretty poorly regulated. But the problem that most of the mining sector faces is that they see themselves having to work with multiple governments, the central government, the provincial governments, the local governments, with no coordination between them, to the point that it becomes unworkable. And what that means is there's fairly low levels of foreign investment, and in fact some people say there may even be a declining level of investment in the resources sector. On the other hand, the companies that are there are highly profitable, and all of them are embroiled, not also facing political issues, because most of the mining takes place in areas which are remote, and the more remote an area is, the weaker the central government, the more likely there is to be local issues between the authorities. When you're in Papua, that's obvious, but in other areas as well, there are political issues between the local communities and the authorities. And secondly, environmentalism. Indonesia faces huge challenges in relation to environmental regulation because it's a great polluter, particularly through the pillaging of its forests, the burning off that occurs there as a result of illegal logging, let alone the burning off that goes on in the burning off season. And Indonesia has made all sorts of wonderful public commitments to, you know, the red programs and to reforestation and so forth, and has entered into agreements with Norway, amongst others, very lucrative programs. But those programs depend on the relevant ministries who, for decades, the ministries responsible for mining and forestry, have been there to facilitate exploitation by tycoons, illegal loggers, most of them in the elite. So the likelihood of those huge commitments actually working out, in light of the record of those ministries, and the fact that they're in cahoots with the bigger tycoons who've made fortunes by these illegal practices and who fund the political parties, has got to be pretty remote. So it's one of these sort of multifaceted, extremely complex problems with a whole lot of conflicting interests all struggling.
So you can't really say whether foreign investment makes things worse or better.
I don't think it's as simple as that. You know, it depends on where you are and what's going on. But a country like Indonesia is not going to be able to hit the growth levels it wants without significant foreign investment. But its track record on managing that foreign investment in a way that the foreign investors are comfortable with is poor and lacks coordination. On the other hand, the capacity to run that foreign investment in a way that is beneficial for local communities is even poorer. It just has never been able to do that. So the likelihood of it getting both those balance, those conflicting interests right, given the problems in the legislature, are pretty low.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we generally finish at 7 o'clock. It's now past 7 o'clock. Would you like a few more questions, or we stop it now? Who would like to ask a question on this side? Oh, there's a lot of people who want to ask questions. Yes, sir.
I visit Indonesia regularly, and 10 years ago, if I had to forecast where the country might be now, it's far better than I would have expected. Wonderful presentation. What's your forecast for 10 years from now?
Well, I travel to Indonesia regularly too, and I also would never have predicted it to be where, in fact I didn't predict it would be, and I got it wrong. So don't listen to a word I say. Just go home and enjoy yourself, do something else. I've always said that Indonesia is doomed to succeed. In other words, it doesn't really matter so much what happens at the micro policy level. It's got a whole lot of things working for it. It's got this huge domestic market. It's strategically located such that there are too many... The powers in the Pacific in 100 years to come will all be deeply concerned in making sure it's stable and functional and doing what it wants. Thirdly, I do think that it has... This is where you can all start thinking I'm losing credibility here, but I think the Indonesian people, first of all, are extremely industrious people who work very hard and are really capable of transforming themselves, and they've proved that repeatedly, historically, that they can come back from appalling circumstances such as 98, when you would have thought they would have decades before they'd recover, or even from 65 and 66, or 45. They've come back and worked their way through it. There's a lot of ability, capacity, and real commitment to making their country work. They're passionately nationalistic about it. So for all those reasons, yeah, I can present these horror stories to you, but I'd be investing.
One over here, right down the back there.
In your opinion, Tim, is corruption as widespread amongst the military elite as amongst other institutions in Indonesia? And secondly, which potential presidential candidates would the military object to, in your opinion, and why?
Okay, military corruption. The official state budgets still only cover about 60% of military needs. Military is grossly under-equipped. Its equipment it has is out of date and not properly maintained. The military has always had to rely on off-budget sources of income. since the revolution and will for some period of time to come. The former defence minister himself, writing recently on this issue, said that if you are able to prevent all forms of corruption in the military, it would collapse. Because the state just doesn't have the revenues to properly fund the military it needs. There's this fantasy about Indonesia having this massive army, and it doesn't. It's about 330,000 people. That's for 240 million people. It's one of the smallest military to population ratios in the world. There's a sort of complete myth about the Indonesian armed forces. They are minuscule, inadequately sized, and totally ill-equipped and poorly trained. So on their own estimate, all they could ever do in a crisis would be to hold three cities. That's their own official position. That's enough for a coup, but it's not really much beyond that. So the short answer is the army has always had business interests for that reason, and business in Indonesia means corruption. Of course, it gets very bad at the extreme end where they sell their arms to rebels. But a lot of it is not at that level. It's about formally owned operations. Now, the army is part of a reform process. It's had to divest a lot of its operations. Many of its businesses now have been sold off. It's received payment for those, of course, but not enough to fund its budget. It's left with a whole lot of non-business interests, foundations and so forth, for the benefit of enlisted men and so forth, which are actually in many cases fronts for business activities. But look, the army's been pushed out of politics completely. It's been split from the police. It used to control the police. It's lost them. It's had most of its official businesses taken away from it. And the government is then left with the problem of how they run it, how they're going to run it, where they find the funds to keep it going. They have to spend 20% of their budget on education constitutionally. Then you've got huge public sector salaries. You've got a social welfare net set up after 1998, which is substantial. Huge amount of the budget goes on subsidies for fuel for the poor, subsidising petrol, kerosene and others. So the capacity of government to actually fund it is very limited, so it turns a blind eye to that. The army will turn around and say to politicians, go ahead, and then how are you going to, what are you going to do if we get into trouble in Papua? So there's a sort of, it's not a simple problem, it's not as simple as it seems.
Yes.
When we travelled to Indonesia with the AWIA in 2008, and I remember being told that the Australian government puts a lot of our aid into the education program, but that it goes predominantly into Islamic schools, which don't really concentrate on the 3 hours. They're more interested in training the kids in the Quran. Is that true?
I hope it is, because I mean they're the schools we should be trying to assist. You know, clearly the aid program should be going to the most backward schools. And
but are we influencing the curriculum? That's really what I'm asking.
Yeah, look, this is the you'll have to bear with me for a second on this. Indonesian education sector, 30% is private, that is religious. So 30% of all the kids going to school go to school in religious schools. Of that sector, there are two sorts of school. One is madrasa, which are government approved or government recognised, and they teach 70% secular, only 30% religious. Then outside that, there are a whole lot of private unregulated schools where anything goes, and they tend to teach heavily religious content. Nobody knows how many there are of either, because there are so many. There's hundreds of thousands, but even the organisations that run them don't really know the numbers. Australian aid goes into the madrasa sector, which are the religious schools, private and state, that are recognised by the Indonesian government and which teach 70% secular material, so that the kids can go and sit the national exams and get jobs afterwards. What the Australian aid is directed to is improving teaching skills and assisting with the secular component of that curriculum, and trying to get them up to the level of state schools, of the secular schools. Now, these distinctions are a bit vague because the secular schools also teach religion. Not as much as the madrasa, but it's mandatory across all schools in Indonesia. So there's nothing really all that controversial about what we're doing. what Australia is doing in its education program. And it's not true that it all goes into the religious schools. There's also significant support going in to the state schools, including recently they built some 2,000 schools within the state system across Indonesia, which is more than the Indonesian government built. So, and it's now into its second round of 2,000 schools in the state system. So the aid actually goes into both private, state-recognised, 70% secular religious schools and into the broader state system. And let me just say, they all really need it. Because one of the big casualties of the end of the New Order, Suharto was brutal, dictator, human rights abuse, corrupt, etc. But he did get some things right. He got literacy right, public health was pretty good, infant mortality went down, we can argue about that. But education hugely improved under Suharto, and after he fell, education really slumped. Hence the 20% minimum expenditure on education went into the constitution. But they're really, the education system is in trouble and it needs help. And it's a great investment for Australia in our future to be in their schools. We might not be building the education revolution all that well here, but if we can contribute to it in Indonesia, and we've got our little map outside those Australian schools, that is a good thing.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been keeping Tim going for an hour and 20 minutes now. I think probably we've asked a bit too much of him, but I would like to, on your behalf, thank the Professor very much indeed for what has obviously been a most stimulating and informative talk here tonight, more than a talk, an address here tonight, and I think it was good that you ended the questioning on a positive note, that we're doing something good up there, because by gee, there were a few, as you said, you know, the good news was limited to about three, the bad news was also limited to three, but it was fairly extensive. It really was a most, I found it, a most stimulating and informative address, and we thank you very much. It's great to have you back here again, and it's terrific that we've got within our educational institutions people like Tim who really know something about the subject they're teaching. So on behalf of the Institute, would you please thank the Professor for coming here?